Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
I'm Kai Brisdell. It is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We answer questions that you, our loyal and faithful listeners, want answers to. So if you've got one question that is about the economy or business or technology, send it our way. We are at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a voicemail, 508-UBSMART. So first up, William on Twitter sent us a question about crypto, which is interesting enough because Kimberly and I were talking before we turned the microphones
just
on.
Just talking about it.
About SBF and FTX and all that good stuff. Sam Bankman-Fried, FTX, crypto. Anyway, here you go. Why do people have large amount of money sitting in FTX, which is the cryptocurrency fund that just went under, thanks to Sam Bankman-Fried? I may not have a ton of crypto, William went on, but even I know you transfer the coins you buy on an exchange to a private wallet so you're not exposed to the risk of an exchange failing. Who's doing this one, you or me?
Me. You know that, William. But a lot of the people who got into crypto through this kind of conduit, the FTX platform, didn't know that. They looked at all these celebrities who were like, are you in? And it's fine to, you know, be joining into this crypto world, even if you don't really know what's going on. And people didn't know. And if you looked at the website, it looked like a regular trading website. And a lot of people thought that they were protected. But, you know, That's one level. We asked Matt Levin, who's our sort of resident crypto expert here at Marketplace, to help us answer this question. And here's what he said. He says, many crypto investors aren't very technically sophisticated, and it takes at least some technical know-how to set up and manage a private wallet, which is what you were asking about in the question, William. For crypto novices or people like me who just have tried to block out as much of it as I possibly could, you know, FTX and those kinds of exchanges made things really easy. You didn't have to make a private wallet. And even if you do have a private wallet, if you lose the, you know, air quote keys to this private wallet, which is basically a password, that money is gone forever. Or if someone steals your keys, as happened to a lot of users early on in crypto, money's gone forever. And there are all these sob stories about people who are digging through their old hard drives, trying to find the keys and passwords for Bitcoin that they mined in like 2011 when Bitcoin was worth a lot more than it is now, or even with what it's worth now. And it's worth millions, but they can't get it because those are private wallets that they've lost the keys to. And so people used exchanges like FTX to get sort of their foot in the door. And it also gave investors the option to open some types of crypto savings accounts with really high yields. And that became really popular with investors looking to make a lot of money fast, especially in the extra low interest rate environment we had up until like the latter part of this year. And so, however, if you have crypto in one of these high yield accounts, you really don't have the same security that you'd have with a private wallet or, say, the savings account at a bank that is FDIC insured. Anyway, FTX really presented itself as a safe, stable, regulation-friendly exchange for crypto newbies. And, you know, again, all of these advertisements and branding partnerships and everything made people feel like it was safe. And this actually came up. The reason Kai and I were just talking about this is because Andrew Ross Sorkin was just interviewing SBF for the New York Times Deal Book conference. And he was asking him, like, people trusted you. People thought this was legit. What were you doing? And he's basically like, my bad.
Yeah. I mean, look, I laugh, but that's not far from what he said. It's not far from what he said, which is just,
it was
oh my God. Listen to yourself, will ya? Anyway.
Okay. All right, yeah. Next up, we've got a call from an anonymous listener who suspects some big changes are in the works for her company.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly. I am S from the greater Los Angeles area. You'll realize why I didn't give you my full name in a second. But there are rumors going around that the company I work for, which is a pretty large international company, is planning on going public. What does that mean for an average employee like me? And is going public always a good thing? Thank you so much for making me smart.
Okay, so companies go public for a whole lot of reasons. The biggest one really is access to capital, right? Getting into the capital markets, the stock exchange, so that they can raise capital, expand their businesses, grow, and do all those things that you can do when you have money, right? Also, if you're a big enough company or a buzzy enough company, and those two are not necessarily the same thing, you can get a lot of publicity, your IPO can turn into a big thing, and thus you get more people wanting to buy either your product or your stock, and that can work out really well for you. But when companies go public, they subject themselves to regulatory oversight. The Securities and Exchange Commission is the primary vessel. The exchanges themselves have requirements. So you have to really be careful if you're going public that you are ready for and are willing to do those things. Also, it's not just all good news, right? I mean, stocks go down too is the shortest answer and the easiest way to put that caveat in there. So what does it mean for you? Look, if you are a salaried employee or an hourly wage employee, probably nothing much. But if you can get yourself paid or compensated in at least partly options for this company, right? If you can get in before it goes public, then that can work out really, really well. Couple of things. Number one, taxes apply and you can get really hosed by options and the tax bracket that you will then fall into. So be super, super careful. And also consult your own financial advisor on all of these things. It can work out really well for you if you can get some options and if you believe in your company, but it can also be a little bit tricky. So that's what it means for you, average worker at a company that might go public. There we go.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. At one point, yeah. You know, when tech was actually hiring as opposed to laying people off, lots of people get lured when startups are recruiting and they can't necessarily pay the same salaries as bigger established companies. What they do is they offer people options, stock options or partial ownership of those companies while it's still private, with the promise that if you give your, you know, blood, sweat, and tears and help us, you know, get big, then when we go public, you'll get a big payday. But for regular folks who come in later, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. Okay, next, a question from Tiffany about elections and their detritus, the trash that comes after them. She says, now that the election is over, what happens to all of the political signs that were in everybody's front yards? And I should tell you, my neighborhood, my town, is a very lawn sign friendly place, and there are a lot of them. She says, are they garbage? Are they recycled? Over to you.
Oh, man, I wish that we could say that they were mostly recycled. Yeah. Well, you know what? They are, in kind of a way, because if you win, you can maybe hold on to those signs for your reelection campaign. And ideally, you have the same supporters that you had the first round. So, yes, in some cases, campaigns will go back and collect those signs, or even people who lose, but they think they might want to run again. I've definitely seen campaigns sending their volunteers out after the fact to collect signs, bring them back and say, okay, I'm going to save them for next time. And then they use their, you know, leftover campaign funds to finance a storage unit to hold it all or whatever. But for the most part, after election season, most political yard signs sadly end up in landfills. And that's because they're usually made of like corrugated plastic or corrugated cardboard coated in this like plastic that with a metal stand in there or a metal framework. Mm-hmm. And those mixed materials are super difficult to recycle and sometimes, in depending on where you live, impossible to recycle. And, you know, as many of us know, whether or not you can recycle certain things depends on your municipality. And it's becoming harder and harder for a lot of municipalities to recycle much of anything because the market for recycled goods has been a mess in recent years. So if you happen to have a political yard sign that you no longer want, maybe you want to keep it up because you're happy that, you know, your person won, or you're bitter that they lost and you want to make all your neighbors regret their life choices or whatever, you know, you should at least try to remove the metal stand from the sign in case your town maybe collects scrap metal. And, you know, organizations like Habitat for Humanity and other sustainability nonprofits encourage people to upcycle those signs. You know, you could make it a canvas for a lovely painting, or materials for a high school engineering project, or, you know, if you have pets, maybe, you know, cats love boxes, maybe make boxes out of them or something. In some cases, yeah, candidates will take those signs back and use them in future campaigns, but And also, that's because those signs are not cheap. It costs like $2 or $2.50 each, according to a DC political consulting firm. So it makes sense if you plan on running again and you print it off, you know, 5,000 signs. That's a not small amount of money. You might want to get it back. So, yeah.
Yep. Good one.
We don't have any experience with yard signs because we're not allowed.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
No, I mean, we as journalists, I was talking about you.
Oh, hell no.
Yeah, no. Yes.
I was like, well, you live in a condo. I can get that. It'd be tough to put a lawn sign out there.
Oh, people find a way. They put stuff in their windows. People will go outside and, like, strap stuff to the light poles or whatever, or hang a flag out their window, and then the association gets all bent out of shape. Anywho. Next up, Annie emailed with a question about charitable donations. Can you make me smart about when corporations such as CVS or Rite Aid ask you to round up or donate some small amount to a charity? Do they get to write this off on their taxes? Are there terms and conditions guaranteeing that my money actually goes to what I'm being asked to donate to?
Yeah, good question. So the basics. First of all, this is your donation. Right. So they don't get to write it off their taxes. It is your donation. And if you, you know, I suppose wanted to keep some record of the 13 cents from rounding up from $1.87 to $2, you could totally do that. If the corporation donates a portion of its profits, that is their donation and they get tax advantage because of that. It does actually, and we check with the Tax Policy Center. And they say that 100%, unless these companies are breaking the law, 100% of your donation does go to the partner charity in question. So that's that. This is called, by the way, Checkbook Charity, really important part of the nonprofit sector. Once again, about $605 million from the 76 highest earning checkout charity. $605 million from the 76 highest earning checkout charity campaigns in the U.S., right? Because they're all over the place. They're at my local Piggly Wiggly. They are all over the place. So they do it, these companies do, if they don't get the tax benefit, so that they can improve their brand reputation, right? So that you have a warm and fuzzy feeling that company X or company Y is facilitating your contribution to the charity in question, which is great. That's fine. No problem with that. Here's the catch, and this is the part that really gets me, because when the checkout person or the checkout kiosk, right, because a lot of times it's sort of a robo thing, says, would you like to round up today? I generally say no, because I like to have some pocket change, number one, and I spend mostly cash as opposed to a lot of people who spend credit cards. But number two is that I do my charitable contributions, and a lot of people do, at the end of the year, and you sit down and you give it some thought instead of spur of the moment. And so it doesn't really jive with how people do their tax or their charitable contributions. Also, there's some judgment involved, right? You feel a little judged. I do sometimes, but, you know, I get over that.
I'm sitting here processing that you mostly use cash. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I'm a big cash guy.
Why?
It's too easy. Man, you just pull out a piece of plastic, and you're like, zip, it's funny money. Never mind. Whatever. But, you know, you hand over a $20 bill, and you're like, oh, God, there goes $20. You know?
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, we take credit cards, and we would be very grateful.
There's a segue. Nicely done.
We would be very grateful for your checkout donation or your checkbook donation or whatever donation you might be game to give us, because it is that time of year and we would really appreciate it. And thank you so much to everybody who supported us on Giving Tuesday. We are going to be, we are going to be fundraising until the end of the year. We're going to be coming out with some new cool offers in the next couple of weeks. And I'm going to have some new swag to show off that I got in the mail the other day, which is pretty cool. But a big, big thank you to everybody for your generosity. It helps Kai have that $20 that he can be real bitter about when he has to hand over.
All right, let's be clear. This money doesn't go to me and Kimberly. It goes to the company.
No.
They get it.
It goes to the
And also,
company.
Just for the record, yes. It's your charitable contribution. It's not the company's. The company doesn't get the tax advantage. So I hope you're listening to that portion of the program. Anyway, oh my goodness.
All right, that's it for us today on this What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. We are going to be back tomorrow to make you smart and hopefully a little bit smiley, too.
If you want to send us a question or a comment or whatever, our email is makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can just leave us a voicemail. It's 508-UB-SMART. We will get it, and we will read it or listen to it and maybe get it on the pod. Don't know.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera and Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Juan Carlos Torrado engineered the program today. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Bridget Bodner is, she says, working on a new season of Million Bazillion. Francesca Lee, I'm just saying.
She slacked me about it today. She truly
director.
Is.
Oh, did she? All right. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, if she slacks it, then it must be true.
It must be true.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.